Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of March 29th, 2013. What I want you to do right now is take a dollar bill out of your pocket, have a look at it, and try to explain why on earth we get so emotionally invested in what is, at the end of the day, a simple piece of paper. Hopes and dreams, highs and lows, they're all right there. So coming up this hour, we join forces with the New York Times to bring you stories about you, your money, and your emotions.
Your gut inside says this could be a problem, but your head overrides it because you've just put in this huge investment to this business.
Based on something that just happened, we seem to be all too willing to throw out well-crafted, you know, rational investment plans at sort of the drop of the hat based on news.
You know, I look at myself as, you know, when I play Monopoly, I go all out. I'm in it to win it.
Our special report, Mind Games and Money, straight ahead on Marketplace Money from APM. No, you haven't tuned into the wrong broadcast. This is Marketplace Money, but a special program courtesy of our ongoing collaboration with the New York Times. The paper's Your Money section this week is intriguingly titled Mind Games and Money. Mind games that, most of the time, we play on ourselves. So in the show today, stories by reporters from both Marketplace and The Times exploring the peculiar emotional relationship we have with our personal finances. Why, when it comes to saving and spending, caring for your pet or choosing your mate, though not necessarily in that order, our feelings very often lead the way and wind up leading us astray.
I bought a pair of Cole Haan shoes, and then I wore them once, and they are, like, so nothing I'll ever wear again, and all I can think is that, like, they were so expensive. They were, like, $600.
I bought, like, a year of life insurance for my parents' friends, because they were like, go talk to this guy. Like, he's a friend of ours. He just wants to talk to you. I just, like, let the year run out, and I just never want to think about it ever again. I'm shameful.
Spent $300 on a tattoo because I thought it was a marker in my emotional history. It was a turning point. So I was like, I got to get a tattoo, and I got to move on, and then that's what I did. So
I just purchased a ridiculous hair product off of the QVC, something Sonic something. It's got pins in it. And it was like $100 that I have no business spending because I didn't get groceries yet.
I spent $28,000 on a car and I regret getting it because of the payments. Too high.
I bought this screen printing machine. It was like $3,000. And I was like, oh man, I'm going to like start up this whole business and I'm going to like do t-shirts. And I ended up selling it for $500. I don't know why it never worked for me.
One time I took a break from my boyfriend of 5 years, and I decided to take my rent money and go on a girl's trip to Vegas. And I realized that it was a bad decision once I came back and had to scramble for rent money.
We should probably begin today. We should probably start our look at the intricacies of our emotional relationship with money with how most of us get our money. We earn it. We work for it, 9 to 5 or however long it takes. But sometimes just having a job isn't enough. And that is when the tussle between heart and mind and money gets really powerful. Because say you want to be an actress or a chef or maybe open a flower shop. You're not going to get it done with just determination and grit, you know, although both will be required. It's going to take some time and often a whole lot of dough. But you should know in advance that things may not end exactly as you'd hoped. Take, for just one example, fashion editor Michelle Dalton Tyree.
Hi.
Hey, Michelle, how are you?
Did you meet the subject of today's interview?
Good to see you.
Pleasure to meet you.
She's answered the door in a fluorescent pink blazer and electric blue shoes.
Well, I did realize today when I looked at what I had on that I had stepped back into the 80s for just a brief fluorescent moment.
Fluorescence on Vogue, my producer tells me, which would make sense, because Michelle's been all about fashion since she was a kid, working retail as a teenager, and eventually at the trade paper Women's Wear Daily.
Fashion and retail were my dreams. I always knew that I wanted to be a fashion editor, and the little side dream was, one day I'm going to open my own store.
The store was called Iconology. She opened it with her sister in West Los Angeles 7 years ago. It was custom design chic, white walls, black trim, refurbished Louis XVI Bergère in hot pink. And the clothes, again, I'm told by my producer, were to die for. Oscar de la Renta, Zac Posen, and
Karl Lagerfeld. It was only us and Fred Siegel. We were the only ones to carry his collection. So we had a few coups. We had a few little tricks up our sleeve that we were very excited about.
Michelle's taste was fabulous. Her timing, not really so much. The store opened just before the recession started to bite. A Hollywood writer's strike didn't help. Actors stayed away and television stylists cut way back on their spending. But Michelle didn't go down without a fight. She threw parties at the store with celebrities like Jessica Alba. She partnered with fashion brands to promote the store. She stocked more inventory. Iconology got plenty of press, less in the way of sales. So after just 2 years, she shut it down.
There is a piece of you that says, uh-oh, your gut inside says this could be a problem, but your head overrides it because you've just put in this huge investment to this business.
When did you know that this wasn't going to happen for you?
As in the business wasn't going to make it? When did you know? Maybe we held on. We held on tight. And I want to say it was maybe about 6 months before we closed. I mean, we were still hanging on till the end, just hoping, because you've put so much into it.
That hanging on to the end thing is what Craig Fox calls the problem of sunk costs. Fox teaches decision making at UCLA, and he says that when somebody has sunk a whole lot of money into something, be it a small business, an education, or stocks, and sees it's not coming back, it's still almost impossible to walk away.
Part of that is cognitive dissonance. Part of that is this, that they don't want to admit that their prior investment was made in vain.
This is our massage room. Isn't it a great ambiance? Can't you just feel yourself wanting to just lay down? Somebody take good care of you and pamper you.
Donna Harris Earle's dreams came true the day she opened her grand salon and spa. Armed with an esthetician's license, talent, and a whole lot of experience in the business, 6 years ago, she took out a small business loan for $230,000. She borrowed another $100,000 from a 401k.
Oh, yeah. Big mistake.
And then spent it all to turn an old bank in Beaverton, Oregon, into a 7,000-square-foot salon with 27 employees, offering every beauty service from facials to hair removal.
You know, I look at myself as, you know, when I play Monopoly, I go all out. I'm in it to win it.
She was winning for a while, and then the financial crisis hit. Her customers disappeared. Donna did what you're supposed to do. She tried to reinvent things, advertise differently. But it didn't work. She had to lay people off, downsize her space, sell off her furniture. She lost her house, too, just so she could keep the business going.
I really was that committed and emotionally involved, and I mean, I was going to go full bore on this, and even if it took me down, it didn't matter because I had already made up my mind I was going to make it work.
Craig Fox at UCLA calls that positive illusion.
The illusion of control. We overestimate our ability to control outcomes that have some element of chance. Overconfidence, optimistic bias that we tend to overestimate the extent to which good things are going to happen, especially to us.
And so people plan poorly.
Because we imagine the scenario of things going perfect, and we don't build some slack into our budgets for time and for money for the inevitable ways in which things can go wrong.
Donna Harris Earle did manage to rescue a little piece of her dream. She still has the spa. It's just a lot smaller now, and she's only got a handful of people working for her. Back in Los Angeles, Michelle Dalton Tyree didn't do so well. She had to declare bankruptcy when her store, Iconology, closed. A financial bloodbath, she says, that she just got out of in December. But it didn't take that long to come to terms with things.
There was a moment, and that moment was when we went to our attorney's office to officially file bankruptcy. And there we were, quaking, tears welling up. And he looks at us, and he said, Michelle, let me tell you something. Some of these companies I work with, they're on their fifth and sixth bankruptcy. You haven't seen anything yet. And I thought, well, God, let this be the last one that I ever do. But it put it in perspective at that moment. And I thought, okay, this is not over for me. This was one piece that failed.
Michelle did salvage something from Iconology's demise, the skills she learned getting press for the store. She's parlayed them into a new venture, a marketing firm for retailers. And she's got a blog. It's called fashiontrendsdaily.com. And all in all, she's satisfied.
It is such a fabulous vehicle for so many different directions that I don't see it now as something, I'm not looking at it as will it fail or will it succeed, because it really has so many legs.
Oh, and that retail thing? She says she couldn't pay her to try that again, dream or no dream.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
You do enough digging around on the topic of money and emotions and why it can be so hard to reconcile the two, and you learn there are a whole bunch of academics out there studying exactly that. Behavioral economists is what they're called, and Dan Egan is one of them.
I'm an expert in human behavior, so you'd think I'd know better than to make a classic investment mistake like selling winners and holding on to losers.
Dan's the director of behavioral finance at the investment advisor Betterment, and it turns out he is just like the rest of us.
We behavioralists call it the disposition effect. It's probably one of the most studied behavioral biases out there. Investors who fall prey to it sell winners and hold on to losers for purely emotional reasons. I made my mistake with oil back in 2009. I had read a few articles and thought the oil price had hit bottom. The only way was up. So I bought into a fund where every 1% increase in the price of oil would net me a 2% return. Then I just sat back and waited for the money to roll in. But the price of oil kept falling. I began to stress out. How could I have gotten it so wrong? Another week of declines followed. Now I was really stressed out. But then the market turned. Soon oil was back to where I had bought in at, and I sold out as fast as I could. Whew! My return? Zero. Well, actually, after factoring in the cost of the trades, I made a 2% loss. Ouch. This was the disposition effect in action. And although I'd studied it inside and out for years, I still fell for it. In the heat of the moment, watching my investment and pride plummet, I was most concerned with ending my anxiety and not feeling like an idiot. This isn't surprising. We know we shouldn't do a lot of things – smoke, drink, eat junk food. But sometimes, the hard part isn't in the knowing. It's in the doing.
Dan Egan. He's the director of behavioral finance and investing at Betterment. The show today is part of our continuing collaboration with the New York Times. We're calling this one Mind Games and Money, stories from reporters at the Times and here at Marketplace, trying to explain why and how we get ourselves so emotionally tangled up with our personal finances.
I don't make a lot of money. I make just enough money to pay rent and food and utilities. But I see this amazing pair of jeans at the sticker price of around $320. Instead of looking at my resources, I decided to buy the jeans as sort of a middle finger to the state of the economy.
I'll see someone who needs money on the side of the road holding a cardboard sign, and like based on my emotions, because I've been in that situation before, I would give them money just because I feel better after I do it. Honestly, I think it's good karma.
I would have to say our first home. I think it was extremely emotional for us being our first time buyers and being in love. And I think it was the most wonderful decision that we've made.
Emotional decision about money probably was the purchase of my house in Italy, which has cost me 15 years of extreme sacrifice to pay for it. And now I'm going to finally see the results of it because it's almost paid within a year. And But it was hard, you know. Everybody was happy in the family, but it's actually separated all of us to go work and to pay for it. It turned out well because I had to roll up my sleeves, go to work, and now after 15 years of hard sacrifice, now I can finally start to reap some of the benefits now.
Voices there from New York, Washington, D.C., and Oakland, California. The last two of them talking about the biggest financial decision most of us ever make, buying a house. Real estate somehow triggers all the big, dangerous emotions, fear, greed, envy, even lust sometimes. So to keep your head on straight and stop your feelings from running away with you, you need a good partner, a good realtor, the kind who knows what you're thinking, maybe even before you know it yourself. So now, a realtor talking about realtors. Allison Rogers is at DG Neary Realty in Manhattan. She's also a columnist at Time.com. Allison, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
You know, so the past like 5-6 years have been tough, right, as you know, in the real estate market. Has the emotional factor changed since the collapse of the housing market?
Interesting question. All real estate is local, so we really have seen two markets. In Manhattan, where I work, probably in some sections of LA where you are, in San Francisco, in DC, it's still hot. And there's a strong emotional factor of people getting into bidding wars and saying, wait, I read in the paper that there was a housing collapse.
Yeah.
How come I'm in a bidding war? So you have that in the hot urban markets. For people in markets where there really was a collapse, markets like Phoenix or Miami, the emotional factor has been, I really don't want to let go of this house. And darn it, do I really have to take a 30% loss?
So listen, how bad a thing is it to do what I did when I bought my house and say to the realtor, wow, I love this house, I have to have it?
I actually think, and I made this point in the Times story, that the more honest you are with your realtor, the more your realtor can help you.
Oh.
So I think you actually behaved perfectly, because if the realtor knows that this is the property for you, then he or she will kill themselves to get it for you.
But don't I then put myself in peril of most obviously overpaying?
Well, the point that I made in the story is that a good, experienced realtor could tell anyway if you were in love.
Yeah, and I'm kind of easy to read anyway, so that's neither here nor there.
Most people are, is the point of the story.
Right. There's an agent in the story who mentions personality types. Let's go through the goods and the bads, right? What's the best kind of person to work with as a person in your profession?
My favorite people to work with, and this is not a type so much as an age group, are the millennials.
Oh.
Because they're so very, very straightforward about what they want and what they need. And they're so direct in their feedback.
Huh.
And as a result, I would lie down on coals to make any of my millennial clients happy.
Wow. All right, well, let's flip the coin then. Who do you, when they walk into your office, who do you go, oh, God, please no?
I'm not sure I've ever successfully closed a deal with an attorney.
I think that says something about attorneys, right? I mean,
sure. Attorneys are, by training, very risk averse, and real estate requires a leap of faith and an assumption of risk that's just not natural to that profession.
So if I am feeling dissatisfied with the person who's helping me with the sale or the purchase of this house, what should I do? I mean, should I just be upfront and say, you know what, it's not working out?
You should be upfront about why it's not working out, give that person a chance to change their behavior, and then, of course, you can fire them.
Hmm.
It's a professional service relationship. One of my sources said it's very much like being a doctor or even a priest. We really think of this as a calling, and we want to help you, and we need to know when you're happy and when you're unhappy.
You know, it's so interesting that you say it's a professional services relationship, which of course it is, and this is not pejorative, of course it is on your end, right? On my end, it's, but this is my house. You know what I mean?
I understand. It's probably the most important financial asset that you have, mm-hmm. and it's also the place where you've had Thanksgiving with your four kids.
Mm-hmm.
So it's both financial and emotional. But on the other hand, we're trying very hard to make you happy because we want to do future deals with you.
Is there a difference in this equation depending on whether you're a buyer or a seller? There must be, right?
I think in general, it's a little harder for buyers because with the explosion of internet data, the choice is now infinite. And buyers can kind of loop almost forever. You know, you can take 2-3 years to buy a property now because there's always new things that pop up on your computer.
Hmm. That would kill me, 2-3 years. I'm like, come on, make a decision, will you?
And that makes you a wonderful client.
Allison, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Kai.
Allison Rogers is a real estate agent at DG Neary Realty in New York City. She's a columnist for Time.com as well. The heart, as we all know, wants what it wants. It also, confoundingly, rarely wants the most practical thing. So you can see where our emotions can get us into monetary problems. Take, settling down with somebody forever. Marriage is, if you think about it, a big financial deal. And yet most of us don't think about it that way at all. A shocking number of people, in fact, get married without ever talking money with their beloved. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith explores what happens when our heart wants things that are bad for our wallet.
So the gas, your credit card, the Xbox subscription.
Vital.
Right.
Jeanette Sturgis and her fiancé, Julian Vargas, are having their weekly household meeting. At the kitchen table every Friday, the two review their finances over a glass of wine. They started having these meetings shortly after they got engaged.
We decided that if we didn't have these meetings on kind of a regular basis,
there would be murders.
Everything kind of falls apart and we get really angry at each other. Yeah.
Between their mortgage, their student loans, and their credit cards, the two 28-year-olds in Aurora, Illinois, have more than $180,000 of debt.
I get a lot of anxiety over money. Pretty much I stay up at night sometimes thinking about our student loans and things like that. I don't know, my parents kind of argued over money a lot, so I never really wanted to do that. So this kind of helps.
Arguing over money is not unusual. It's a top reason couples divorce. What is unusual? A couple talking about money before they get married.
In our society, money is really a taboo subject, almost like sex.
Relationship expert and author, Dr. Terry Orbuck.
But I think money is even more a taboo topic. So these days, friends are talking about sex, but we rarely know how much our friends make. We don't know even how much our parents make.
Add the blinders of romance to the mix, and you've got a recipe for not talking money. Even when passionate love wears off a bit, 12 to 18 months later, according to Orbuck, people have no idea how to broach the subject of money.
So when we are now jointly financially responsible with someone else, we don't have the vocabulary to talk to this other person about money.
Susan from Washington State didn't talk about money with her fiancé. But after they married, she learned he was a closet spender who would constantly drain their bank account. When the couple was splitting up, he
racked up considerable debt in my name on wine, women, and song, and he had a better lawyer.
Susan got stuck with $30,000 of that debt, which she had to pay off while putting her kids through college.
Yeah, that's a big source of resentment, let me tell you. But in the end, it's a good lesson.
At 64, Susan's been in a relationship with a financially stable partner for 8 years. They live together, but Susan says she won't get married again.
No matter how much you love someone, it's a risk to be responsible for their financial behavior. I don't want to take that risk anymore. I don't think anybody should, frankly.
25-year-old Emily Grover wants to minimize that risk. At a popular singles bar near New York University, Grover says the way a man handles his money is very important to her.
I've learned from past relationships and just from my own upbringing that having financial stability is something that's really important to me in a relationship.
Grover says she tries to get a sense of someone's financial responsibility early on.
The beauty of online dating is that you can kind of filter out people from the get-go. So you can see if they have, you know, a college degree, if they have a postgraduate degree. Sometimes they even list what their income is.
Since the financial crash, many daters have gotten more financially picky. Several dating sites have cropped up that cater to them by requiring people to list their credit scores. Grover hasn't gone that far yet, but she steers clear of free sites, which might attract the broke and indebted.
It sounds so unromantic and horrible to say, but I've worked hard to get where I am, and I've worked hard to not have credit card debt and to be paying off my student loans ahead of time, and that's something that I want to look for in another person.
That discomfort with factoring finances into the soulmate search is not uncommon, says family therapist Lair Torrent. He says his single clients often hesitate to bring up financial concerns about a significant other.
Our popular culture puts it out there that it should be puppy dogs and ice cream.
So there's this sheepishness about bringing up the money issue. I'll have people say, well, I don't want to sound like a gold digger. They get that a lot.
Jeanette Sturgis and Julian Vargas have overcome that. They hope their weekly meetings will ease them into the financial side of married life. Vargas says tackling their debt together has made them stronger as a couple.
It gives us something to come together and attack as a team. Our debt becomes this exterior antagonist.
He was an English major. That's why he talks about exterior antagonists.
That exterior antagonist has taught Sturgis a few things, too.
I think I've learned to kind of relax a little bit more about it. Mm-hmm. I try not to obsess about it.
That's why we have a wine budget.
Yes, we do have a wine budget.
And a wedding budget. Vargas and Sturgis opted for a 2.5-year engagement so they could save for the wedding they wanted. Their attitude towards couples who don't talk about money before they get to the altar?
I guess all I can say is good luck.
Right?
I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
All right, so fess up. How emotional are you when it comes to money? My guess is that you're more emotional than you think, but take our quiz and find out for yourself. Also, now's a good time to go grab a pen. You're going to want to write this down. We've got an infographic on the happiest and the saddest cities in the U.S. and worldwide. There's a video explainer about a business's goodwill and lots of good facts about money and emotions, all in a special section at marketplacemoney.org. All right, so you remember that dollar bill I mentioned up at the top of the show? You could probably give it away, no problem, to somebody in need or another good cause. But the bigger the amount gets, the tougher it is to let it go. Charity is an amazingly complicated issue, emotions-wise. Guilt, sympathy, stress in some cases. Americans give away, on average, about 5% of our earnings. Some give more, some less, but a select few of us give everything. Paul Sullivan is the Wealth Matters columnist for the New York Times, and in our special section this week, he writes about young people who've inherited money, big money, and who feel duty-bound to give all of it away. Hey, Paul, how are you?
Hey, Kai, how are you?
I'm good, but hook me up, man. Why are these young kids giving their money away?
Crazy, huh?
Honestly, it's a little
Yeah, I mean, they have a different thought. I mean, this particular group, they're motivated by social justice. I mean, look, for decades, for a century or more, people have been given money and they've squandered it. These people are being given money and they want it to have a positive impact in the world.
You talk about them as trust fund progressives, which I find an interesting juxtaposition.
Yeah, I mean, they have all this privilege. They realize they have this privilege. Yet, I mean, they want to say, you know, can we do our little part in making the world a little bit more equitable place? And this one woman, Jessie Spector, she inherited a little over $500,000 from her parents, and she didn't know what to do with it. They'd already paid for her to go to college. She was starting off in life, and she said, you know, there are a lot of problems out there. There are a lot of problems that this money could benefit. And that's what she set about doing. She set about finding out ways to give this money away. And lo and behold, there's this organization out there called Resource Generation that brings together all kinds of young inheritors and helps them solve this issue of how to give their money away to organizations that matter.
How much of this is angst and guilt over their position in society?
Angst goes a long way in motivating all of us, I think. And that's, you know, there's certainly a part of it here. But it's a little bit more sophisticated than just thinking, look, I got all this money, I don't want it. It's more, why me? You know, why was I the one who was born to the grandfather who made all this money in finance when somebody else who's just as smart, who works just as hard as I do, wasn't? And so they're looking to take a positive change, make something positive out of that guilt that they feel.
How are they doing it? I mean, are they just writing checks or what's the mechanism?
They are writing checks, you know, to traditional nonprofits, to charities. They're also making low or no interest loans to organizations that they believe in. And lastly, they're helping their friends. They're perhaps, you know, buying a new car for somebody who needs to drive to work or helping somebody pay off a big medical bill.
Paul, not to be crass here, but how much money are we talking about?
You know, Kai, I asked him that same question.
It ranges from both my parents have professional careers, and when they pass away, I'll inherit their house worth $500,000, but maybe not any cash, to right now I have access to a foundation that is worth over $100 million.
Let's be clear here. These folks are not just giving away like dividend checks and extra income on their $20 million. They're actually dipping into principal and giving away the principal.
Right, which, you know, any trust and estate attorney would say this is anathema. Yeah. You should never, ever do this. And they're giving away, you know, vast sums. I mean, one fella I talked to inherited about $1 million. And in the late 1990s, he was trying to give it away, you know, $5,000-$10,000 at a time. And it wasn't working because back then the stock market was going up so quickly that every bit of money he gave away got replaced. So he got frustrated at one point. He says, I'm just going to divide it up into thirds. I'm going to keep a third and give two thirds to these two guys that I grew up with. And from there, he started taking much more radical steps with giving the money away quickly.
Here's the cynic in me, Paul. You ready?
Go.
How much of this is young idealism? Because 55-year-olds think differently than 25-year-olds.
You're absolutely right. And this group resource generation, its membership is ages 18 to 35.
Yeah.
And they kick them out when they're 35 and become cynical.
It's like Logan's Run. Paul Sullivan at the New York Times. Paul, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Paul Sullivan is the Wealth Matters columnist at the New York Times. His most recent book is called Clutch: Why Some People Excel Under Pressure and Others Don't. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Kai Ryssdal. You're listening to Mind Games and Money, a partnership with the New York Times about, just like it sounds, the tricks our emotions can play on our personal finances. So you love them, you care for them, you feed them when they're hungry, cuddle them when they're cold, take them to the doctor when they get sick. Yes, kids, if you have them, but also pets. Tess Vigeland has a house full of them, cats and dogs. One of the things she's been doing the past couple of months is reporting on the cost of pets, how expensive they can be to care for, and how painful the choices about keeping them healthy can be. Here's Tess.
I visited my vet just a couple of weeks ago with my 3-year-old black lab, Ronan. He's allergic to something, probably our grass, and gets this nasty skin condition. So Dr. Woody Walker of the La Cañada Pet Clinic took a look.
All right. Yeah, Woody, we're going to figure you out. Come here. Let's just see. Oh, good boy. Yeah.
By the time I left, we had done a blood test, an office exam, gotten two prescriptions and a special shampoo, plus a prescription refill for my cat's thyroid condition.
It's going to be $492.76.
$492.76.
Yes.
I told Ronan he needed to get a job. But this is what happens when you have a pet. It's expensive. In fact, here in the U.S., we spend collectively $53 billion a year on our pets, for everything from medicines and operations to food and toys. In our house, we're lucky that none of our four animals has a terminal illness, because if and when that happens, I don't know what we'll do. We've tried to set a number for what we're willing to spend to save or extend any of their lives, but that conversation never resolves itself. And Dr. Walker says those decisions have gotten much more difficult with advances in medical care for pets.
The technology is amazing. Whatever we can do in people, we can do in pets.
For John Noel, the decision was fairly easy to spend more than $10,000 for a kidney transplant for his 13-year-old cat, Pumpkin, who he proudly shows off in a photo.
That's Mr. Pumpkin. And this is was taken 6 or 7 months post-transplant. And then we have a picture of Hopi, who's the donor.
Noel is a deputy sheriff for Los Angeles County, a public servant who doesn't boast a large paycheck.
I work hard for my money, and I don't have a whole lot of it, but, you know, there are priorities in life.
He found Pumpkin wandering the streets as a 5-week-old kitten, and like most pet owners, described him as part of the family. Money simply wasn't a factor in his decision.
And when you have that kind of love in your heart for another creature, be it an animal or a human, I don't think anybody who has that love and that feeling would ever think otherwise.
And Pumpkin triumphed over long odds, living another 4 years post-transplant. Dean Philip Nelson of the College of Veterinary Medicine in Pomona, California, says societal pressure plays a role in many pet owners' decisions about end-of-life care. The agonizing questions around human end-of-life medical intervention have now made their way down to the pet kingdom. And owners often feel guilty if they don't do everything possible, no matter the cost, to save or extend their animals' lives.
I think it's harder, not just because of the technological answers, but I think our own ethos have evolved, and not necessarily in a good way. I believe that, and this is just a personal belief here, that many of us are loath to have to face the end-of-life issues. And some of us have been mesmerized by the advances of medicine.
Of course, not everyone can afford to even contemplate expensive treatment. Alana Yanez of Highland Park, California, sees that situation firsthand in her work with the U.S. Humane Society's Pets for Life program, which provides veterinary services in low-income neighborhoods. She's counseled pet owners going through decisions about how to care for their animals. And last October, she faced it herself when her 11-year-old Labrador Retriever Max started limping. Her vet said it was cancer.
And chemo, what he told us was minimum $10,000. And it would have been a really long and hard process.
The vet told her Max was in pain and that unless she had $40,000 laying around for the surgery and aftercare.
He goes, I would put him down. So we decided to do that. I still sometimes struggle with whether or not we made the right decision. Because, you know, putting $10,000 on a credit card, I could afford it. And I think, would that have been worth it if it would have extended his life another 5 months or 6 months?
In the end, she says she's confident they made the right decision. And now she comforts herself with one-year-old shelter dog Dottie. If I thought this story would help me figure out how to plan for the inevitable with our pets, well, it didn't. These are deeply personal decisions, sometimes dictated by cost, more often dictated by that thing that happens every time a cat curls up in your lap or a dog rests his chin on your knee. And there's no right or wrong in that. In Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland for Marketplace.
Emotions and money are a complicated pairing in the best of circumstances. But you throw in the parent-child relationship and things get messy in a big, bad hurry. Messy, kind of like this. Senior citizens are racking up debt to pay for stuff for their kids and their grandkids. And those grown children are digging themselves into a hole to help mom and dad in their old age. Carmen Wong Ulrich is a personal finance journalist and the author of a book called The Real Cost of Living. She writes in our special section with the New York Times this week about seniors and their emotional relationship with money and, sadly, with debt. Hi, Carmen.
Hello, Kai.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. So what is it? Give me a sense of how bad it is with seniors.
Well, it's recently historically gotten very bad. There was a survey by Demos and AARP. They found that the average credit card balance for folks over 50 is now bigger than for folks under 50 by about $2,000. And this is the first time that that's ever flipped. And it really says a lot to what's going on with that generation.
Well, what is it, though? What are they doing, seniors, that get them so much debt?
Well, a lot of them are helping other family members. The report also found that nearly a quarter of those over the age of 50 say that they gave money to or paid the debts of relatives, but doing it by adding to their credit card balance. Hmm. So they're going into debt for other family members who are in financial trouble. And I talked to Katina Rojas Joy about what she's done for her mother.
I have helped my mother with money by wiping out several of her outstanding credit card debts, which cumulative is about $15,000. My mother doesn't have medical debt, school loan debt. All of her debt is consumer related.
Why is it, Carmen, that some seniors actually wind up with debt problems and some don't?
Well, I think a lot of it is psychological. You know, what is the mindset that says it's okay to get into debt? And what we're seeing a lot, these kids of Depression-era parents who really went the opposite direction. And part of it is after, of course, you know, the Depression and after, especially the 60s, what we saw was this, you know, you can have the better toaster, you can have a better car, you can have, you know, and there was a lot of needing to upgrade. And it's the first generation of keeping up with the Joneses. But then you add to that in the 80s and the 90s, easy access to credit. And also a great housing market for a while there. Mm-hmm. And you have an ability to basically live well outside of your means.
This is a little heartless, but wouldn't seniors be doing A, themselves, and B, their children a favor if they would just say, you know what, I can't now. It's a little bit like they tell you on airplanes when you're flying with a kid. When the oxygen mask comes down, take care of yourself first, then help your children.
Always. You know, I talked to a financial planner and she said, it is a gift, and I really believe this, it is a gift to your children to take care of yourself first. And, you know, if you say to them and they say, oh, I want you to pay for this private school and go into debt for me, it's up to you to say, you know what, if I do that and dip into my retirement, I might possibly have to move in with you. And something tells me they may back off a little bit if you put it that way.
Yeah. Assuming you're not willing to bring out the big guns of moving back into home, how does this cycle of I need to help you because I feel guilty about all this other stuff, where does that stop? How do you find a solution to that?
Listen, if most of the trouble, financial trouble, comes from helping family, you'll need to go outside the family for the support. So first, maybe you need to meet with a nonprofit credit counselor. Maybe you need to meet with a financial planner to show you just how much this is actually going to cost you down the line, and to also form a plan that you can stick to get rid of the debt, to be able to say no, and even get some support from your community.
How do you broach this conversation with your parents, though, right? Because if I went to my mother now and said, Mom, let's have a conversation about money, it would not go well.
Yeah, I've tried that with my parents as well, and it doesn't go very well. One thing that seems to work for a lot of folks is to be a little bit of a detective. So as Katina mentioned, you know, look and see who's calling the house, what kind of mail are they getting? Or even just bring up in conversation, you know, so I see, you know, you're still driving the same car, everything good? And make it just a part of back and forth, you know, how are you doing conversation? But sitting down and having a straight up talk about money would be the best case scenario, but it's very rare that they would want to do that.
Carmen, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
Carmen Wong Ulrich is a personal finance journalist, also the author of The Real Cost of Living. If there's one thing we learned from the financial crisis and all the other crises ever, it's that we never learn that it's a bad idea to let your emotions rule when you're handling your money. Because, come on, how many people do you know who rode the Dow all the way down in 2008 and then sold at the bottom, or who've bought within the last month or two with stocks at record highs? Sell low, buy high is just not the way you're supposed to do it, right? Time and again, we let panic or euphoria drive our actions in the markets, and we wind up making big, expensive mistakes. Financial advisor Carl Richards blogs about human error and emotions in investing for the New York Times. Hey, Carl, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So why do we keep making these same mistakes? I mean, it's not like you can't look around and see what's going on.
There's something sort of fundamental, it feels like, about human nature to take the recent past. I think that's the biggest problem we make, right? Is we take the recent past and we project it in the future. And so based on something that just happened, we seem to be all too willing to throw out well-crafted, you know, rational investment plans at sort of the drop of the hat based on news.
Yeah. And you point this out actually in your piece. I mean, you talk about these stories that we tell ourselves to rationalize away our behavior.
Yeah, over the last, 15 years, I've noticed the same stories keep popping up. But we've got to tell ourselves some story. And then, of course, we go look for evidence to support the story we tell ourselves.
Well, so what's the most common story? What's the one that, you know, makes you slap your head when you see it?
It may be hard to talk about this one now, but I think 2008, 2009, the story we get ourselves so wrapped up in is on the way down.
Yeah.
People coming in and say, I just got to get out. And, like, why? And here's the story. Have you seen what the market's doing?
Right.
That's the story. It's got so many problems in it because we don't know what the market's doing. We only know what it's done.
Right.
And somehow we tell ourselves the story despite knowing that, you know, what's happened in the recent past is no indication of what's going to go on in the future. Despite knowing that sort of on a factual, theoretical basis, we tell ourselves the story that if I don't get out now, I've even had people calculate, if I don't get out now, it's only 18 months until I have no money left.
If the Dow went to zero tomorrow.
That's right. Yeah. If this continues, I'll be done in 18 and a half months.
But you know what? That happens on the way up too, right? I mean, I was doing, not to name drop, but I was doing Piers Morgan on CNN the other night. It was the day the Dow hit its first record high of many. And he said to me, is this a good time to be getting into the markets? And I looked at him and I said, have you lost your mind?
You know? That same, like, I've got to get in on this or I've got to get out is sort of two sides of the same coin. But I have an issue with this idea of, like, is now a good time to get in?
Yeah.
Because I think it makes a fundamental assumption that we're all sitting on a big pile of cash trying to decide if we should get in. If you're in that situation, you've got a different set of problems.
Talk to me for a second about the emotions that are involved here, right? Unpack this a little bit. There's definitely fear, but there's also excitement. There's a bunch of stuff going on.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that's really important is to give ourselves permission to acknowledge that those emotions are normal, right? They're human. We are hardwired to get more of those things that give us security and or pleasure, and hardwired almost genetically to get away from anything that's causing us pain. So I think fear, there's greed, there's all the societal issues of, like, what are your neighbors doing? And we all sort of chuckle at that, like, oh yeah, that's high school peer pressure sort of stuff. I'm immune to that. No, we're not.
The problem with this whole thing, though, Carl, is that the only story that really matters, just to continue with your theme, is decidedly boring and just monstrously unsexy.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure you've run into this. There's only so many ways to make it exciting to say, hey, build a rational plan based on your goals and stick with it. Like, that's the only story that matters. Right? If your goals change, your life changes a little bit, revisit the plan. If the market changes, go back to the garden, right? Like, that's the only story that matters. But it's much more fun to talk about, you know, what's up, what's down, day trading, hedge fund managers, all of that stuff. Way more fun.
And that's what gets us to the hindsight problem, right? Because you have all this fun and then you look back and you go, oh, man.
Yeah. And I guess what has to happen, I wish we could all learn based on the experience of others, but it seems to me I've gone through this, right? You need to make this mistake yourself a couple of times to realize that risk and reward, that's a fundamental law. And every time you try to break it, it breaks you, right? And in hindsight, you look back and say, gosh, I wish I wouldn't have done that. And then you do it again and you do it again. And hopefully at some point you go, okay, that was enough. I guess I'm just going to stick with this giant body of evidence that says it should just be boring.
Carl Richards, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Kai. Thanks for having me.
Carl Richards is a financial planner up in Park City, Utah. He's the author of The Behavior Gap, Simple Ways to Stop Doing Dumb Things with Money. We don't usually do this on Marketplace Money, but on that other show that I work on, I usually end with a final note. So today, a confession on the way out. I've been listening to the show go by today, ticking off on my fingers the parts I can relate to. A distressingly high proportion, truth be told, because I'm just not a guy who's thoughtful about money. I mean, yeah, I save for my kids' college accounts. I do the whole buy and hold for the long-term investment strategy thing, and I try not to carry a whole lot of debt. But in the money moment, I'm a classic act first, do what you want, think later kind of person. Not long before I started working here, hosting shows at Marketplace, which is, honestly, my dream job, I was working at a bookstore, a now bankrupt bookstore, I might add, Borders, making $7 an hour. It was a good job, don't get me wrong. Flexible hours, good discounts on books. But it just wasn't where I saw myself at the age of 34, freshly married, about to have a baby, and having just quit a totally secure and stable government job because I just didn't like it. It was a little bit scary. Obviously, it worked out all right, although how I eventually wound up here is a whole nother story. But this is the lesson I've always taken from that time in my life. Sometimes you got to go with your gut, money or not. You have to do what you know is going to make you happy. Because when push comes to shove, money's only a tool. Your emotions are what's real. And that is Mind Games and Money, our special collaboration with the Your Money section of the New York Times. Do let us know what you thought of the show at marketplacemoney.org or on our Facebook page.
If you happen to be the kind of person who likes to comment in 140 characters or less, we're on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Coming up next time, how a trip to the Monkey House can teach us a lot about the office.
We see things like dominance displays, we'll see posturing, we'll see submissive behavior where animals move out the way of each other just in the same way that we might try and avoid certain people sometimes.
This special hour of Marketplace Money was produced by Devin Maverick Robbins and Patty Hirsch. Megan Larson worked on my Dream Jobs piece. Our thanks to Ron Lieber, Lon Teeter, and all the staff at the New York Times, and to Daryl Perinata and Brendan Willard here at Marketplace. Our theme music was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.